Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Witchcraft and magical practice have been indelible parts of the human experience throughout recorded history. Wherever there have been people practicing magic. It shows up in all sorts of places, TV shows, fantasy novels, and that strange shop on the corner that smells of incense and has shelves lined with crystals. But what if I told you there is an actual formal discipline of study when it comes to the history and practice of magic? Owen Davies is a professor of history at the University of Hertfordshire, whose career has been spent largely researching witchcraft, magic, and ghosts. He is the president of the Folklore Society in the UK and the author of, as of this recording, 16 publications on the subject. And the reason why I had imposter syndrome the entire time I had this interview. He's considered one of the world's leading academic experts on the study of witchcraft, and he took some time out of his very busy schedule to chat with me about witch trials, the fact and fiction of real witches, and, naturally, Taylor Swift. It's a fascinating interview with a personal hero of mine. Hope you enjoy. Owen Davies, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire.
Pleasure. Pleasure, Don. Thanks for the invite.
So for folks who don't know you or your work, tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm a historian, social historian, cultural historian of witchcraft, magic, ghosts, magic books, grimoires, essentially the supernatural religion, popular religion and popular medicine. And I tend to follow this through thematically. So I will look from ancient world to the present. A lot of my research is probably, you know, from the 16th century onwards, but I always draw back and look at parallels into the ancient world, particularly also and the medieval period. But also I'm always interested in global comparisons and also interested in ways in which historians and folklorists, and I'm also a folklorist, can draw upon other disciplines and other research, whether it's anthropology or sociology or, you know, biomedicine even.
You know, I do want to define that term quickly. You said that you're a folklorist. You're the president of the Folklore Society, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm currently, I'm 2 years into my 3-year stint as president of the Folklore Society.
Well, congratulations, Mr. President.
Yes, right.
I'm curious because here in the US, at least, most of us do a unit or two or three on mythology. You get your Greek gods, maybe you do some Norse gods here or there. We do a little bit of mythology. Folklore is different. For folks that don't know the difference between mythology and folklore, could you define the term?
Well, yeah, and it's different in different countries. You know, folklore is a discipline distinct from mythology or anthropology. All this is rooted in really quite complex history of how academic disciplines developed from the late 19th century. So in America, folklore is a well-established discipline in American universities. I think some 24 different universities have MA programs in folklore. Harvard does folklore mythology, for example. So it's very well established. Whereas in Britain, myself and colleagues run the only MA in folklore in England. There's no undergraduate programs, hardly any modules, no nothing. And all this comes down to relationships between folklore and anthropology, as I say, as disciplines. So what's essentially happened is that in some parts of the world, anthropology just dominated, and comparative religion and comparative mythology is part of that, you know, which was a strong feature, as you say. Mm-hmm. And folklore, which is allied, is sometimes it's difficult to tease apart what, you know, the difference between ethnology and ethnography and anthropology and folklore. But folklore is a broad church which can be based on field work and interviewing, just as anthropologists do, going into the field. It can be based around looking at comparative mythology as well. But also it's based on looking at legends, contemporary legends. So I would say that the distinction between folklore and mythology studies or comparative religion or whatever is in a sense in the broadness of what comes under the umbrella of folklore. And that's what I find quite joyous about folklore is that you could take so many divergent paths in it and you're still doing folklore.
You know, you've spent so much of your career studying and writing about witchcraft. I'm curious about what about that subject fascinates you academically?
Yeah, I mean, it's a question I get asked quite a lot. You know, how did you get into studying witchcraft out well, and magic as well? It's always a difficult, it's a sort of organic sort of process, you know. I mean, I guess, you know, one strand of it would be being interested in reading fantasy novels, you know, early on as an early teen. Wanting to know where some of these ideas and thoughts came from, particularly the authors that inspired me from the fantasy world, which are people like Ursula Le Guin, Alan Garner, Jack Vance as well, actually, as a science fiction sort of folklore crossover there. So part of me was just kind of stimulated by, I think, fantasy literature as an early teen. And then studying history, just being generally interested in folklore and ideas of mythology as well, which obviously a lot of those fantasy authors actually pick up on ancient Greek, ancient Norse mythology in particular. And so wanting to know more about that. And then as an historian, thinking about the importance of these beliefs right into the present. So, you know, go back 30 years and the idea of history of witchcraft was very much considered to be an early modern topic, early modern 1450, 1750, you know, and that was it. So, you know, the idea of studying the continued relevance of belief in witchcraft and magic in the Western world, was considered to be a matter of folklore, you know, not history. And I remember, you know, struggling as a early academic to get people to take it seriously because I was studying 18th, 19th century, 20th century witchcraft and magic and say, this is just as relevant, you know, go back 150, your great-great-grandparents were very likely believed in witchcraft, very likely may have known someone who was accused as a witch. At that period, they might not, you know, there's no laws against witchcraft, but it's relevant. It's relevant to our ancestors' lives quite more immediately. And, you know, I showed that in a book called America Bewitched, where right through the 1950s, 1960s, people are still being shot dead for witchcraft in a very traditional way, which you could see parallels with, you know, the 16th and 17th centuries. So, yeah, part of me, a lot of me is inspired by the idea that the supernatural is just as relevant and present today as it is in the past, and that it's just as important to study it and research it and explore people who still engage with those forms of belief. It's just as relevant today as it was, you know, 100 years ago, 500 years ago.
I think a lot of people, certainly myself included, will be really glad to hear you say that you came from the world of fantasy literature, pop culture. I mean, just, you know, that little spark of magic somewhere out in the world found you and you said, there has to be more here. There's got to be more. And then, you know, sort of that fight to get it seen as a legitimate form of study. I think that you know, it'll make people really happy because I think some folks in sort of the modern witchy circles or people who are interested in it almost feel a sense of shame in saying, oh, you know, I came to this because I really liked practical magic or I watched Sword in the Stone and I really loved that. So I think people enjoy that was your path. Speaking of modern practitioners, as you are very likely, no doubt aware, there are many modern practitioners of witchcraft around the world. And oftentimes their practice stems from the work of folks like Gerald Gardner or Aleister Crowley or Margaret Murray. There's this idea that modern magical practitioners or occultists are continuing an ancient tradition. How do these modern practitioners differ from the witches of history or the witches of folklore? Or is there indeed some kind of long, unbroken tradition of witchcraft?
it's a really complex question, and obviously people like Ronald Hutton have been unpicking mm-hmm. this for many years. And I work with, particularly through the work I've done on cunning folk, this is where mm-hmm. it really kind of connects with modern practitioner movements and stuff. And I have to say, you know, I'm never judgmental about this, because the whole point of what I'm interested in all this is because it's current, it continues. It's how it continues and the way which people engage with it as practitioners today fascinates me just as much as in the past. But it is different, you know. I will absolutely clear, there is no unbroken tradition of somehow witches persecuted in the 17th century, 16th century, and modern practitioners, no, it doesn't exist. Gerald Gardner was a fantasist, clever, and created a movement. Nothing wrong with that. Every religion has to have a founding kind of back history.
Sure.
Doesn't matter what, every religion has it. And it's not about being false. It's not about falsehood. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really interesting, the way in which modern magical practitioners, whether they're Wiccan or not Wiccan, and increasingly, in my academic career, I've seen a massive shift from organized religion to individual pagan practitioner. That's happened in the last 30 years, you know. And most of the people I speak to today who are practitioners, and I have students who are practitioners, belong to the kind of individualists. They don't want to be part of a hierarchy or a coven. And then there are problems with the degree of patriarchy in sure. early Wicca and stuff, you know. So I think it's really been quite liberating what's happened over the last 20 years. And the awareness that, you know, people like Ronald's work and stuff and others have shown that there is no unbroken past, but that doesn't mean it's not legitimate. You don't need to have that. You can borrow, every religion borrows from other religions, and that's no different whether you're part of a grouping or chaos magicians or whatever, or you're just an individual who's engaging and has their own spiritual magical journeys, borrow from it, and that includes, you know, from overseas or whatever. It's mixed, but you're creating your own understanding of the world and vision and how you think magic means to you. And I think that's actually been a really interesting and liberating aspect over the last 20 years, from what could be seen as a rather stifling, we might call, first half of neo-paganism from Wicca onwards, which was about orders and hierarchy, comes from the Golden Dawn. You know, you must progress through this to a more liberating hedge witch, the hedge witch movement stuff. So that's my take on this, is that no, there is no unbroken tradition. The people prosecuted for witchcraft and magic in the early modern period, you know, some 40 to 60,000 people, mostly women, who were executed for this terrible, terrible thing, were not part of some sort of pagan cult. They were not part of, they were not even doing what they said they had been doing. So a few of them may have been involved in cursing and muttering curses and stuff, that we know that happened. But that doesn't necessarily gate, it's not saying that because you call yourself a witch today, there's an issue, the problem. I don't have an issue with people calling themselves witches today or practicing witchcraft today. It's a malleable term, it's a protean term. It's fine. I'm fascinated how people engage with the past and engage with that history, and that's great. And that's, you know, a lot of people who read my books are practitioners, and fascinates me how they use historians' work, and vice versa. I've benefited from work of practitioners, particularly those who have transcribed, you know, magic books, 17th century. Practitioners have made a really important contribution in the last 25 years to the understanding of magical practice in the past. So it should be a really positive and an interesting creative relationship.
You know, you brought up the witch trials and what some used to call the burning times. And I have many headaches over that.
It's
the Murrayite theory, is a problem. 9 million women and all of the things.
Absolutely.
But I am curious, because there's this idea that that many of the witches, or many of the people who were burned as witches or who were prosecuted for witchcraft, were actually folk healers, practicing medicine and things like that, midwives.
To your knowledge, is that based in fact? Is, you know, was this a great battle of doctors trying to, you know, drive out the folk healers?
No, this is a persistent. I have to say, this is one of the persistent issues with where I have it is problematic the way in which a kind of a popular understanding of it, because no, the short answer, yes, some, whether it doesn't matter where across the continent, yes, there were some midwives, there were some cunning folk, wise women, wise men, however they're called in different countries, different cultures. Yes, a small minority in general. Overall, there are regional patterns and differences. Mm-hmm. But in general, a few were caught up. And mostly they were caught up in the witch trials when they were accused by their clients. In other words, someone who went to a cunning person, a wise woman, or whatever, and said, I'm bewitched. And they forked out a week's wages on a charm or whatever. And then things got worse. And they go back and said, oh, yeah, I just paid you 5 shillings. Why am I still worse? And then the thing is, well, you probably didn't carry out the ritual well, or whatever it happens to be. And in the end, after they've been sponged for all their life savings sort of thing, they go, I think you are bewitching me to take my money, etc. So quite the small number come from that kind of transactional relationship. Mm-hmm. In an English context, I've just been working recently, looking at this actually, there are a few cases where under English law, which is also obviously American common law, into the 18th century, because there's a line in the Elizabethan Act of 1563 and the King James Version 604, which says that you could be prosecuted under the Witchcraft and Conjuration Act for detecting stolen goods and property. And so you do get a few trials which come targeting astrologers in particular, astrologer physicians, but that also includes cunning folk dabbled in astrology. I've not come across one that was successful. In other words, they would go to court and they would say, well, I've just published this book on astrology. No one stopped me publishing this book on astrology. why am I guilty of a capital offense when I've just been allowed to publish this? You know, so those don't work, you know. So they do get caught up in a small number of cases. Now, whenever I have this discussion, people then go, oh, what about Iceland? What about Finland and Sweden? Yeah, that's a different issue there, because these are about that cultural battles between indigenous populations and in a sense, you know, Europeans. So you do get a lot of trials in Sweden and Finland against Sami shamans and indigenous shamans for practicing magic. Yeah, that happens. You can see a similar thing going on a bit in Iceland. But those are discrete and different things to the bulk of the trials, which are in Central Europe. You know, that's where the bulk of women were tried. So yeah, no, it's a persistent. A lot of that myth comes from second wave feminist literature, from Ehrenreich, Barbara Ehrenreich in particular, which is very widely read in the 1970s. You still see it floating around the internet. But, you know, any historian of gender, any historian of witchcraft will say exactly the same thing as I'm saying about this. No, it's not a persecution of midwives. No, it's not a persecution of female healers. It is, the witch trials are a misogynistic and patriarchal act targeting what are seen to be the most vulnerable people, susceptible to the wiles of the devil. And that's very gendered, and that's very misogynistic and patriarchal. But the facts are that no. Sorry, that's a long-winded response to your thing, but it's out there so much.
It is,
and I think I've said this before a number of times, that, you know, I thought we were getting somewhere 25 years, and social media came along, and all these things just have become all over the place again. You just kind of go, oh, God.
Well, and I think, you know, that's one of the reasons I was so keen to have you on, because, you know, I've been in witchcraft spaces for 20 years now. I'm very old. it's difficult to figure out what information that you read in books or what information you see on social media or in an article that's supposed to be, you know, fact-based. Yeah, I see all these articles, you know, these sources cited. But when you go down the rabbit hole a little bit, it's difficult to find good information and good teachers about this information.
Yeah, sure.
And it seems like there is, as much as practitioners have contributed to the understanding of history or the contextualization of history, it feels like at times, at least from inside the community, that practitioners sort of butt up against the academic community. They don't want the academic community to be correct. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, it's still there. It's still there. I mean, it was quite strong, you know, again, 25 years ago, you know, that was pretty strong there 30 years ago. I think it's lessened a lot, but I think social media has kind of re-strengthened it a bit. I mean, there's a two-edged sword with social media, because I can put out tweets and stuff and provide information as lots of other people do, and that's great. But then the other side, there's this torrent of other stuff.
Social media doesn't tend to reward good information. It tends to reward things that get engagement. And oftentimes those two things aren't the same.
Exactly. And there's also a tension there, because a lot of academics are expensive, you know.
Yes.
And the internet is cheap. And so I do meet a lot of practitioners who by and large only read practitioner histories, if you see what I mean. So practitioner histories of the history of witchcraft. And which is interesting in itself. And part of that is due to access. And if you're not an academic community, how would you access all the latest research that comes out in articles and stuff?
Sure.
And I think there's a role for more academics to be out on social media to kind of counter this stuff, although it's often futile because some of these things are so entrenched. But I think, I mean, my main thing about here is that the modern practitioner community doesn't need to have necessarily a deep history in terms of identification with individuals or groups in the past. Have a relationship with the ideas about magic, the ideas, the practices, that's fine. It's when you then identify with groups in the party going, well, actually, these people who were prosecuted in 17th century, has no relationship at all to pretty much any practitioner group, really, because they're people who are accused of crimes they didn't commit. Simple as that. Long and short, you know, again, as I said, apart from the small number who were prosecuted by clients or attempted prosecutions for astrology. But it's an ongoing thing, but I think it's got a lot better. I think the relationship between academic scholars on this and practitioners is pretty in quite a good place, actually.
Good. I want to ask about labels. You actually brought this up earlier, and it's a great line of questioning. You said, you know, your grandparents, your great grandparents probably knew witches, probably, you know, went to witches or something, or sought their help. There are a lot of people. Half of my family is from Appalachia, West Virginia, the Ohio River Valley, that area, where you would have, you know, granny magic and that kind of thing. However, none of the people in my family would have ever called themselves a witch, ever.
You just
whistled to get the wind to dry your laundry. That's just what you did. You know, you hang bottles from trees, or you do, you know, these kinds of folk practices. Let's talk about labels for a moment. Do labels help? Do labels hurt? How do you properly create a label for folks who would have never called themselves a label? I mean, is it even fair to sort of project a label onto folks who wouldn't have called themselves that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, the big one is, you know, if you call yourself witch or whatever, what sort of witch are you talking about, in historical context? And but that follows on from what we've just been talking about. And there were people called 17th century labeled white witches. You know?
Yep, so absolutely.
To call yourself a white witch, that's a historic term, and it was used 400 years ago. It was used 100 years ago to talk about cunning folk, wise women, and conjurers and stuff. But as you say, there's a whole bigger world there of what I call popular magic, or you call it folk magic, or whatever. In other words, there are specialists and, you know, and they are particularly specialists on witchcraft or detecting or use astrology, or they might have expertise in herbal medicine. They're often learned, or they say they have powers from the fairies, or they're seventh sons or seventh daughters, or they're learned from book magic. And then there is a whole world of rituals, spells, which are communally owned, in a sense, you know. Mm-hmm. And call it folk magic, call it popular magic, or whatever. And that's commonly owned. That's passed down orally. Sometimes people write it on the fly page of a Bible. And obviously in the 19th century, in particular, you know, good American examples like Long Lost Friend or whatever, you know, it's written down. It's written down. It's printed.
I have a copy right here.
I've got lovely copies. I love that book. And it's printed. And so, you know, from the 18th century onwards, whether it's in France and popular grimoires there, this gets printed. So it gets democratized. So for some things, you still rely on the practitioner, the expert, the cunning person. There are some things you wouldn't possibly do unless you've been to them. And at the same time, there are lots of forms of rituals and stuff that people just perform because they knew about it. It had been passed down. You just say granny magic. It's a nice term, you know, or grandpa magic. And those are passed down. They're held in communities, lots of herbal remedies, herbal magic, simple astrological forms of when you do things at certain times, those sorts of things. And again, you have increasingly the 18th and 19th centuries, people resorting to cheap, popular books, like Long Lost Friend or Six and Seven Books of Moses or whatever. So it's kind of DIY. It's DIY. So the whole idea of, you know, modern practice is in a sense an echo or continuation of the past, where you took information where you could and you made what sense of it you wanted.
Talking about sources and research, how much do you see the presence of circulating folklore, such as like a magical practice as evidence of that practice versus having a historical document that presents an account of a practice as evidence of it, like a trial record, where the motivations might be muddled due to coercion?
Again, it depends what you're arguing, because the literary archive, whether it's manuscript or printed, is only a tiny representation of the diversity of beliefs, traditions, rituals, or whatever, which are passed down orally. So, you know, I am a historian and a folklorist, and so in some senses I will prioritize what is the evidence, what is the archival evidence. This comes into play particularly when it comes to the material culture of magic and building magic and the idea of concealments in buildings, apotropaic or whatever. And I have done and worked with a colleague, Kerry Holbrook, and about what is the evidence for a practice which has been assumed in the 20th and 21st centuries about the past, but there's a gap between the actual practice as archaeological and what modern interpretation is. And if you know as a historian what the sources are, you can go back and think, okay, I'm going to do this systematically. And then you find no evidence for this practice being magical at all, you know. But it's become, and this is the thing that Kerry Holbrook and I have worked on with a book, which is called Reenchantment. In other words, a practice like concealing a horse skull or a mummified cat or whatever. There's no evidence in the historical record that was ever interpreted that till you get to folklore theory about survivals and pre-Christian rites and religions and folk culture in the late 19th century onwards. But it's not about being true or false, because lots of people believe that a mummified cat today is an apotropaic. It's all part of belief. It's all part of how we've interpreted these things. So again, the question you ask raises all sorts of really interesting issues about relationship between past and present, between the nature of evidence, material, archival, printed, oral. And there is no hard and fast, and this is all part of a continuum of the way in which magic, which was so fascinating, a magical practice, gets invented, reinvented, reimagined, and that's ongoing. It's ongoing.
You know, there's an interesting point that you bring up that is sort of a hot topic on social media in the last few years, and it is about ownership and culture and which cultures own you know, what practices and where do practices come from, and sort of finding, you know, where was this invented and who owns this, and, and that kind of thing, cultural appropriation and all of that. It is difficult, at least as far as I have found in my own research and attempts to understand the matter, to find where certain things do originate. Like you said, you know, there are topics that when you research them, you find, well, I don't know when that became magical. Because it just seems to have started as a this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, very Seinfeld, yada, 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 300 years, now it's witchcraft. Do you find that to be true?
Oh, yeah. You know, you're absolutely right. Because there's a lot of beliefs, practices where you can't pinpoint the origin. You can't. You know, and those are the gaps in which people have the imagination to say they're pre-Christian or whatever. You know, often there's no actual evidence for that, but there's no evidence when it actually started, you know. So you come back to much broader principles of notions and ideas, and you know, and lots of people have worked on this and saying, you know, there are aspects that of medieval, post-medieval belief and tradition. Think about the Green Man, or Green Man representations in English churches, medieval churches, or whatever. And there's been a long debate about that as to whether are they pre-Christian representations that have survived or not. But there's plenty of evidence to say they are basically Christian in the Christian era, not about paganism, but other broader notions about nature and God's world. You know. I mean, we've just working on a big project on witch bottles, and that's a good example of what you're talking about, you know, where in fact I think I have got back to a kind of sort of initial where it came from, around the 1640s. These are the, you know, the Bellarmine witch bottles with bearded man, Bartman, necks, which, you know, and obviously that's spawned hundreds of TikTok and YouTube videos about making your own witch bottles and stuff. You know, lots of stuff. It's great. I mean, I spent hours watching some of that stuff. You know, it's fascinating what people are doing. But you know, it draws back on this idea of the Bartman bearded man bottles, you know, as being the kind of the originator of this. But I think I have probably come across, but that's only about the bottling. All the other aspects of it, using urine, putting pins and needles, nails in it, sharp objects, sympathetic magic, putting on the fire, that dates back further. Where does it begin? You know, someone somewhere in the 1640s decides to put it in a stoneware bottle, put a cork in it, and roughly do the same things you might do in an open pan in the Netherlands and 100 years earlier. Or evidence of a 15th century Italian prosecution where he's doing fairly similar stuff, using urine, putting sharp objects in it as a kind of curse ritual. He gets prosecuted. So, you know, so much of magic is about symbols. It's about unit construction, to put it in a rather unmagical way. There's units of how, whether in ancient world or today, different aspects of magic can be put together, recreated like Lego or whatever, and reformulated. And that's the wonder of it. That's why it's so vibrant. Trying to find an version, or you know, the origin, whether it's pre-Christian or Christian or whatever, sometimes just becomes irrelevant because you can't.
The platonic ideal of this particular practice. Yeah,
you can't.
Originated.
You can't. Exactly. And you know, you could look at this, you know, in a comparative way with biblical scholarship and the ways in which, you know, a certain genre of biblical scholarship has tried to prove where the ark is, you know, tried to prove the parting of the Red Sea. That's not what it's about, and you can't prove it, and it's futile. You can understand the biblical legends without having to try and find dubious material evidence that it happened at some certain point through excavation.
What do people keep getting wrong about Salem? You've written a lot about Salem over the years. It seems to be a pet topic of yours. What do we keep getting wrong about it?
I don't think it's about being wrong about it. I guess my frustration with it is how it dominates. American perceptions, and that comes through because of the schooling system, the way in which Salem has become this iconic moment. And whether it's the American Revolution, the Civil War, Salem, these are these key points where America moves on, you know, from one era to another. And it becomes problematic because Salem is, in a sense, exceptional. So in other words, all those scholars working on 17th century colonial America can point to other episodes, you know, before Salem, which are more typical. And from my perspective is that, yeah, Salem's fascinating. And one of the reasons actually it's fascinating is because how soon after people are going, oh my God, we got it wrong there, you know.
In researching a show a couple of years ago, I was sort of going back through information about Salem, and I had completely forgotten how brief it was. It's just a blip in history. I mean, it almost didn't happen. We've had weather patterns that lasted longer than the witch hunt in Salem.
it's very late in the western sort of chronology of mass witch trials. It's very late due to very specific, which has been studied in millions and millions of pages. Mm-hmm. And one says that's great. You can't study an episode any more than it has been studied. Literally, you know, 20 years on, they're actually offering payments to family members of those who were executed. And it's like, no, never. It's the Salem never again. Never again. Even
sure. 1720s, never again, the burning Salem, times, absolutely.
Exactly. And yet, you know, American society is, you know, massive development. So, you know, my point is that, you know, okay, 1690, go to 1890, massive population. You've got, you know, you've got over 100 different nationalities, you know, massive European movements of population in the 19th century. And they all bring their folk traditions, customs, and concerns about witchcraft. And, you know, as I've shown in the sort of America Bewitched, you know, I've only probably touched the sort of top of the iceberg on the number of local trials in the 19th century, which I would call reverse witch trials, which is people who have been accused, abused, assaulted for being supposed witches, who then prosecute. So this is ongoing. You know, this is an ongoing history. And to only focus on Salem and colonial America 69 is, I find, well, I mean, it's not just about America, it's about other countries as well. It's problematic to think that we moved beyond that. We moved beyond. Salem happened, and then that was it. That was the end of the witch trials, and we all realized how mad it was, you know, blah, blah, blah. And yet, you know, 200 years on, people are still being killed in America. In Europe as well.
And then the satanic panic swept through.
Yeah, it's right. 1970s, evangelicals, you know, whipping up concerns. 80s, 90s, about,
and today.
And today, exactly. And, you know, how far are we? How far are we from people being, you know, I put out something on social very briefly, and I took it down because I didn't want the hassle. It was basically saying, in the current state of things in America, not just in America, again, things in Britain aren't too good either on these sorts of things. Basically saying, if someone, you know, if a leading American politician, won't name names, basically said, we've got a problem with witches in our communities today, you can imagine within weeks there will be abuse problems across large swathes, millions of people. It only takes that sort of messaging, and we're kind of back into a similar situation. And that's, as I say, I'm just using, because we're talking about Salem, but that's elsewhere, you know, that's elsewhere. It's, the veneer is thin, and the idea that we've progressed beyond these things is, I think, dangerous.
Well, and politicians do still talk about witches and witch hunts.
Yeah.
But even more so, especially here in the United States, where politics and religion is so intertwined, you do have maybe not necessarily the politician themselves, but their advisors who happen to be religious figures, pastors, you know, these giant mega churches, you know, who do give sermons and say that there are witches out there actively doing work against this politician or actively doing work against the church. We just had one this past year. I forget his name off the top of my head, but it does still happen, and it raises a lot of concern for folks.
Yeah, and the interesting thing in the contemporary context is, of course, there are now hundreds of thousands of people who are self-identify as witches and magical mm-hmm. practitioners, you know, and hundreds of books, and you're part of that.
I wrote one.
But it's a fascinating dynamic where you've got people who self-identify at the same time. Mm-hmm. You've still got what you might, I'm not even going to go into old mentality, a continuing mentality. Mm-hmm. That there are these others who have or profess these powers. So it's all this is still current, and yet the context changes from people who are, in a sense, part of a supposed conspiracy in the mm-hmm. past, and that's what led to the laws against witchcraft. It's about conspiracy, and yet here we are today with other conspiracies, 5G or American elections, or you know, whatever.
Yep.
And you can see the parallels there, and going, there's this whole community of people who are practicing magic. At what point does that cross over and start, you know?
Well, merging? I think you're correct. The context is important, and like, you know, our earlier chat about labels and of saying that people are witches, or what words mm-hmm. people would choose for themselves. The context of what someone means when they say the word witch is very, very important. A modern magical practitioner saying that they're a witch is, you know, saying one very specific, slightly ambiguous thing. But what these political folks say when they mean witches is something very different. What people say when, oh, witches are being tried, you know, the witches that were put on trial, that's a very different thing as well. Mm. Which is a word that we keep trying to ascribe meaning to, and the witch just doesn't want to be defined. I don't know.
No, absolutely. Very potent. And obviously with Donald Trump and witch hunt and the witch hunt thing, I use that as an example. I'm talking about thinking with history for our students and thinking with history. And I use that example of going, here we are, and witch hunt has become a massive thing. And there's very, I can't, one of the American news spaces to really think about a witch hunt tracker.
Sure.
It was a really interesting tool. To then compare with saying, what does the witch hunt today mean today, and how's it being used in the context, and what does it mean to people who are self-defined as witches, and how they're reacting to the way in which this is being used today. So current, yeah.
What does the average layperson get wrong about witches? You know, maybe not practitioners necessarily, but what does the average person get wrong about witches and history and folklore?
The main one is the conflation between witches as a label applied to others in the past. Mm-hmm. No one self-defined as a witch in the 16th, 17th century, because it's a capital offence. Even in the 19th century, no one would say, I'm a witch, I practice witchcraft, because it's considered malign. It's, you know, you're going to get beaten up for it. But there are these people called cunning folk, or conjurers, or wizards, or magical practitioners, or folk healers, or whatever. So people are doing stuff, lots of stuff, providing lots of magical services. They're not identifying as witches. They're not calling themselves witches. Occasionally, they're accused of witchcraft. And that conflation continues, is very strong today, still. And I think kind of does a disservice to those accused in the past. And at the same time, neglects the importance of magical practitioners in the past as well. You see what I mean? What those who are accused and executed are labeled as crimes they didn't commit. And at the same time, there's a large group of people who were also maligned, supposed witches by witch hunters and governments, who are actually doing good things for communities as they sit.
And then you have folks like John Dee in the court of Queen Elizabeth, doing whatever
wanted. For elites, but for the vast majority of people, it's your local cunning folk who's probably about, you know, maybe in your village, but maybe 5-10 miles away, who's going to deal with your love problems, who's going to detect the horse that was stolen, the identity of the thief that broke into your cottage, who's going to deal with your bewitched cow, who's going to provide you with herbal medicines, who's going to provide you with charms, who's going to provide and those people, one of the reasons they rarely get prosecuted is people don't want to prosecute in a common law. This is about legalism, in America and Britain's common law. It requires an accusation from someone to go to a magistrate for it to end up in court. It doesn't happen very rare, you know, very, very occasionally, because people value these people in their communities, but they're not witches as they understand it. You know, that's so that's the challenge. And as that doesn't mean I don't have any issue with someone calling themself defining as a witch today, because many of them self-define and go, actually, I'm a cunning person. And the term white witch provides this sort of, you know, bridging terminology.
It is interesting that you bring up the subject of class, because, like you said, for the elite, even though it might be illegal or frowned upon or you know, something like that, the queen can still have her court magician, and magic is always still accessible for the ultra rich. There's certainly a class thing there for access. So another question, like I said, I want to be respectful of your time. I've written a book about witchcraft. I've hosted a podcast that's talked to a whole lot of self-described witches over the years. And I am asked a lot, if somebody is brand new, if they have read their own fantasy books and they have seen their movies and they are also inspired to find a little spark of magic out in the world, where do they start? And I feel like you would have a really interesting answer to that. If somebody was interested in learning more about witchcraft and magic, where would you send them? What books or resources would you send them to? Other than your own books, of course.
I'm not gonna promote those. That's all right. I think it's a dual path here, and I think lots of practitioners have taken this dual path as well. And one is to read how over the last century. Well, three parts, actually. How over the last century in the Western world, modern occult magic developed. You know, whether it's the Golden Dawn through to Wicca, through to hedge witchcraft, all the other variations in between. What is it those past practitioners who have developed modern practice have drawn upon? So that's important. And what is it? How have they constructed their rituals? Two is to recognize that a lot of that history is also based on exploring and understanding other cultures. Mm-hmm. And modern Western magic is based on, obviously, you know, this, you know, with theosophy, et cetera, and Eastern mysticism, often very badly interpreted, and also, obviously, then with the rise of understanding of hieroglyphs and Egyptian magic and Egyptian ritual and original magic. So you need to understand that, explore your own pathway through how early modern practitioners have used the past and drawn upon it for inspiration. And then thirdly, read the history, read the modern history. Read what modern historians and anthropologists are writing about the meaning of magic, have contextualized the early practitioners, contextualize and understand interactions, quite going back a long way between European culture and Eastern cultures and African cultures, which is a long, long history which doesn't get explored that much. So it's a kind of, three pathways there. And I think you'll come to a really good place about where you want to situate yourself. But do read the academic work. Do read the if you can. You know, and there is lots out there which is available, open access. There are lots of PhD theses you can now access, open access. There may be a dry read, you know. And that is an issue. I've had that in the past. I write academic. I have to write academic books because I have to submit to research assessment exercises and government exercises.
Publish or perish.
I have to write. Exactly. I have to write like that. We all have to write like that because it's our livings.
Have you tried writing like that while doing a TikTok dance? Have you?
Yeah. No, I haven't got to TikTok yet. No. I'm a bystander on TikTok. But yeah, so it's those three ways into it, I would suggest. And I think a lot of practitioners come there naturally anyway, to that position of.
What do you think magic is?
I can't answer that one.
Oh,
can't answer that.
Listen, my editor, I wrote a whole draft of a book and I didn't want to define it. And she's like, you have to. And I was like, I hate you. So you have to as well.
Yeah.
Because you're the expert here, sir.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wrote a book, whatever, 10 years ago, called Magic, A Very Short Introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And
you also wrote a book called Paganism, A Very Short Introduction.
Yeah, I did. That's right. I did both. Yeah, exactly. I probably can't. I can't say any more. You know, 10, whatever, 12 years on, I probably can't do any better than that, because it is a matter of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can do is set you out the context. That's what I do. I set out the context and say this is how magic is understood in the past by different cultures, different groups, at different periods, at different times. How you personally understand it is kind of up to you. And in one sense, you know, great if you're going to be informed by all those different historical, cultural parameters and perceptions. But, you know, lots of people come up with their own definition quite individually out of their own imagination. I'm not the sort of historian that tries to impose that. I'm not trying to find solutions. I'm just exploring and explaining and
providing context. People
giving context and giving information, and then find your own pathway to what you think magic is, because you'll never get to a definition that anyone's unanimously going to agree with, and let alone the relationship between religion and magic, or religion, magic, and science, you know. So.
That's very true. putting literally any definition down into black and white is terrifying, because you just know it's going to be picked apart.
Yeah, exactly. You're never going to please people, and people are going to be nuts about it.
Yes, you are. You have studied witchcraft and magic for a very long time. Have you ever done any yourself? And if not, do you have a favorite spell that you've read?
No, I mean, I'm not a practitioner. I do keep a few items. So I have three, for example, I have a collection of charms, particularly some most coming from research and stuff, for particularly First World War research I did on soldiers' charms and talismans and stuff. I do have three echinoids, which are three fossilized sea urchins on the windowsill, just as a carrying on a tradition which is about protection. And I have in the past had a reproduction of a Welsh cunning folk's charm from the early 19th century, which I did put above the threshold. So, you know, I'm not divorced from it, although I'm not a practitioner, put it that way.
Do you believe in it? Do you believe in magic?
Well, that comes back to what is magic, isn't it?
Sure.
Put it this way, I don't practice magic. I'm very much a secular outlook on things, but at the same time, I think magic is inherent in the human condition, however it's expressed, and that magic can be through fiction and fantasy. It can be how you talk to children and explain things to children. I think that's one of the more fascinating aspects of how magic is inherently human. Is, you know, people who explain to their kids, I don't have kids, but people who explain to their kids about, you know, why does an aeroplane work, daddy or mummy? And then you come up with some ridiculous explanation which bears no relationship to aerofoil engines or whatever in engineering. So in other words, people resort to magical explanations. People want to have a magical. Why are we seeing such a resurgence in UFO interest? You know, you know, I've been through all that before in the 1970s, you know, but here we are again. And it's because people want to believe there is something out there that people want to believe. So to me, magic is inherent, and however it's expressed, I don't see it as negative. It can be negative, it can be positive. I think magical thinking, believing in magic, which is not necessarily the same thing as magical thinking, is just inherent. It's an inherent part. This is why I don't subscribe to Richard Dawkins and science is all, and religion is evil, and we must quash religion and magic because we're in an age. It's rubbish. Where science can be much as much a matter of magic and belief and religion as as science is part of, you know, magic is a part of science in the past, you know. So long-winded, which shows you just how difficult it is to talk about magic, you know, in a more general sense, because it's so personal.
Final question, and I'll let you go. You are the president of the Folklore Society. And with that comes, I feel like you're one of the only people who could answer this question. In 2020, Taylor Swift, or should I say after today, who got her honorary doctorate, Dr. Taylor Swift.
Oh, right. Okay, I hadn't seen that. Right.
Yep, okay. Apparently she got an honorary doctorate today, day we're recording this. So Dr. Taylor Swift put out an album of music called Folklore. Yeah. And did a whole big promotion on social media with it, taking over the infamous Folklore Thursday hashtag on Twitter, which upset the very stuffy academic folklorist community. So I have a question. Do you have beef with Taylor Swift? And if so, how do you settle that beef?
No, I've got no beef. I did tweet about that, and I did tweet her directly as president of the Folklore Society. And I said, it's great you're interested in talking about folklore, you know, with, through music and song. Great if you could do a bit of promo for folklore, the discipline thing. So, no, you know, it was fascinating how that all blew up. And as I say, as president of the Folklore Society, I think, and my colleagues and members of the society generally thought it was a really positive thing. Has to be said. It's just a shame if she'd only put out a statement supporting the American Folklore Society, the British Folklore Society, and the great work we've been doing over the years. Then that would have been better.
I do appreciate the official finger wag from the president of the Folklore Society. Owen Davies, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. It has been an honor getting to speak with you. You're a personal hero of mine, so thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks for the invite.
Bye now.
Okay, bye.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Head on Fire. My eternal gratitude to my guest today, Owen Davies. Do please go follow him on social media. You will not regret it. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Share it with your friends on social media. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners just like you. Help keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Or if social media is your thing and you'd like to follow me, I'm pretty much at headonfirepod everywhere. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for downloading or streaming the show. And remember, just because you know how something works doesn't mean it isn't magic.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.